There are lots of figures thrown around in this war that you have to try and wrap your head around. Back earlier in the year when I think it was the British journal, The Lancet, came out with the figures that with the supposed Iraqi death count at that time was 650,000. An American left winger had this to say about it to try and apply it to if this were comparable to in the United States. He said comparable casualties in the United States, with of course something like 15 times the population of Iraq, would mean that every person in Atlanta, Denver, Boston, Seattle, Milwaukee, Fort Worth, Baltimore, San Francisco, Dallas, and Philadelphia would be dead. Every single person. If you look at the latest figures, which is a million, and apply that to his counting, you can add the city of New York of 9 million people to that. That's what the scale of it is for the people of Iraq. But the figure for me that in some ways sums up the approach and the attitude of American imperialism in this war is slightly lower than that. And that is that the largest U.S. embassy anywhere in the world is located right now inside the Green Zone in Baghdad. There are 1,000 civilian workers in that, civilian employees in that embassy. Does anybody here want to venture a guess how many of them speak Arabic? Six. I mean, the Arabic language is not some obscure dialect only spoken on a mountaintop in New Guinea somewhere. There are 350 million speakers of this beautiful ancient language, and the most powerful empire in the world has found it necessary to only have six people be fluent in the language of the country that they are occupying. And I think that we're all accustomed to the arrogance of American imperialism, but to me, that kind of figuring sort of really sums up the utter contempt that the people who run our society have for the people that they are at war with. You know, and it's, but of course it's causing quite a bit of problems for the people at the top. Even Bush, I never thought, ever thought I would quote Bush favorably in a talk, but I have to say he did have a pretty good zinger the other night. They have these things they call roasts in the United States. The press club gets people together and the politicians sort of make fun of themselves. And Bush, who we know did not write this joke, somebody wrote this one for him, but he read it well. He said, a year ago, my approval rating was in the 30s, my nominee for the Supreme Court had just withdrawn, and that my vice president had shot someone. Ah, those were the good old days. And I think it's a rare moment of humor from George Bush, who's not only sort of a lunkhead, but he's also sort of got kind of a tin ear for humor. But it really does capture what is happening, the unraveling of the situation, which, of course, we on the bottom of society, on the left, love to watch unfold. For example, in the Afghanistan war, early on, a very famous American football player, who, of course, like all American football players, has a multi-million dollar a year contract, actually quit his job as a footballer and went and joined the armed forces and went to war in Afghanistan and was one of the first people killed. And the U.S. government, the Bush administration, put on huge nationalistic flag-waving extravaganza parades. And what's come out this week is that they knew right from the beginning that he was of casualty, not of combat, but of friendly fire, what they call friendly fire. He'd actually been killed by other American troops. And they had made an enormous deal of it. And this, of course, is one of the scandals that they're dealing with. The Speaker of the House of Representatives, so people understand the sort of pecking order in the United States, it's the President, the Vice President, and the third most powerful person. You know, if the two of them get kicked off, we get Nancy Pelosi. So the Speaker of the House is then number three. She now has in her offices in Washington, D.C. Now, keep in mind, she's a Democrat because the Democrats just took control of Congress. She now has the family of a Marine who is paralyzed, who is mostly, I think he's a quadriplegic right now as a result of his injuries in Iraq. They are sitting in her office making demands because the U.S. government is refusing to pay his medical bills and pay any kind of restitution, you know, so much for support the troops. This is the kind of stuff every day is unearthing these kinds of enormous scandals that are striking the administration. And, of course, the backdrop to all of this are, you know, the economic numbers that just came out that show that the top 1% of the United States now has a larger share of the national wealth, larger share today than at any time since a very interesting date, 1928. Which actually, the top 300,000, which I think comes down to like the top 0.01% of the United States, has the exact income of the bottom 150 million Americans. So this is the context in which all of this stuff is unraveling. And of course, but my point here today is not to go on and on about how much the world sucks. We could do that for, well, we'll do it in the bar afterwards, and we all know it. But what we really need to talk about is what can you do about it? Because what we propose as socialists is workers' power. We believe that the people who produce the wealth in society ought to control that wealth and ought to democratically control how society is run. Now, obviously, the first argument that people come up with, and it's not an unreasonable question to ask, is how is it that workers could possibly ever run the society we live in? Most working people, after all, accept a number of ideas that justify the status quo, having their heads at any given time alongside of perhaps some progressive ideas, lots of crap ideas, racist ideas, homophobic ideas, sexist ideas, all that sorts of nonsense. But even more prominent, I think, even if you're somebody who's got all sorts of progressive, you know, sort of left-wing ideas about those sorts of things, it's probably the most common idea that workers have in their minds is that there's really not much that you can do to change the world. Things suck, but they've more or less always been like that, and the best that you can do is sort of go along to get along, you know, meet me at the bar, that kind of thing. And Marx had a very succinct way of putting it. He said that the dominant ideas in every society are the ideas of the ruling class. And so the schools, the churches, the various institutions, and obviously the media, all of these various outlets for the top class in society to disseminate their ideas are hard at work in reinforcing these sorts of backwardness. But I think in some ways the very fact that they have to go through extraordinary lengths every single day to repeat backward crap tells you something, in my mind, about how unnatural these ideas are. Because if these were the natural ideas that we all had in our heads, then why would you have to spend billions of dollars, you know, promoting them? People would simply have them, and you don't have to bother inculcating people every single day with, you know, you're powerless, you're stupid, you're worthless, you're going to work, you know, stand in size order, blah 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 blah. And I think that's an important thing for us to understand. There's nothing natural or inevitable about the mixed consciousness that most workers have in their heads at any given time. Now, another idea that people have is that human nature is just basically too selfish and greedy, that we're never going to see any kind of fundamental change in society so long as people remain selfish and greedy. And it's not the point that Marxists think that, you know, oh, no, no, people are really glorious individuals. They never, you know, cut each other off in traffic or, you know, cut online or treat each other like crap. They obviously do. But what we understand is that people's nature is neither particularly good nor particularly bad, but it's particularly blank. And is often shaped by the society that you live in. And that's how you can begin to explain why it is that it's very unlikely that as we leave here, to, you know, from this room this afternoon, that we're going to beat the crap out of each other on the way to the bathroom to push each other over from the tap. Because we know that if we want water, there's going to be plenty of water later on. When there's plenty of something, you don't go and you're not in competition for it. There's plenty of it. We don't have to fight over it. But, of course, as soon as that resource is made rare, is held from us, then, of course, people are pitted into competition. And that's precisely what the society that we live in does, a society based on profit for the few and the squelching and denial of human need actually, you know, throws us into competition for schools, for housing, for health care, for all sorts of things, things that ought to be due us by virtue of just being on the planet. You know, but you also see counterexamples in which for moments you can see glimpses of how people could actually act otherwise. I mean, the response around the world, really, not just around the United States, to what happened in Hurricane Katrina was actually quite enormous. Most people didn't turn on the TV, see a bunch of poor people, you know, who've lost absolutely everything, and say, fuck them, good thing it's not me. You know, most people were absolutely horrified, absolutely traumatized by the reality that in the most wealthy country on the planet, you can have hundreds of thousands of people basically lose everything, and the government does absolutely nothing. And, of course, here we are 19 months later after that devastation, and they really haven't done very much. But it's a source of outrage for people, and we have to question, why is it, you know, that outrage enough doesn't seem to be sufficient for people to overcome the way our society works? And so what socialists argue is that we also need to understand that struggle is necessary in order for us to get change, because struggle itself transforms people and gives them actually confidence in their own power. If you have no confidence that you can possibly change anything, you know, you're not about to go fight to change the world. If you won't even fight for a 15-minute bathroom break, you're highly unlikely to change, you know, to argue or fight for the transformation of society as we know it. You've got even small struggles can be transformative for people. And we understand that struggle is central to the shifting of ideas in society. And this is the way Marx put it. He said, revolution is necessary not only because the ruling class cannot be overthrown in any other way, but also because the class overthrowing it can only in a revolution succeed in ridding itself of all of the muck of ages and become fit to found society anew. In other words, yes, it's true. Lots of us do have shitty ideas. But actually, in the course of the struggle itself, we're forced to confront those ideas, and they're challenged by the struggle itself. For example, if you look at the average strike, workers are forced to deal with the fact that there were divisions in our ranks, divisions that have been sown throughout our lives, right, told that, you know, women are this and they shouldn't be on the front lines because, of course, they're very meek and they're very fragile and we have to take care of them. Or, you know, blacks, they're, you know, lazy sons of bitches, they're going to just cross the picket line anyway. You know, all these kinds of crap ideas that we've, you know, had pushed into our heads, that we've been bombarded with forever and a day, are forced to be confronted. I know, you know, a few years ago, in the south of the state that I live in, a few hours south of Chicago, a place that's not particularly cosmopolitan or urban or anything, there's a town of Decatur, Illinois. Now, there's no reason at all why you should have ever heard of it. As a matter of fact, I had never heard of it until three companies went on strike simultaneously, not something that happens all that often in the United States or anywhere else in the industrialized world right now. Caterpillar, Bridgestone, Firestone, and a place that basically processes the stuff that goes in beer, whatever that is, were either locked out or on strike simultaneously. And this is a town, it's largely white, although there is a number of blacks in the town, in which the Ku Klux Klan actually had organized a branch, which, you know, doesn't actually happen in most cities, by the way. It's not like the Ku Klux Klan is a growing operation. You know, we don't have little fascist gangs. But this is one of those towns in the United States, a small town in America, you know, sort of downwardly mobile industrial town. When that strike happened, actually, because, you know, they were confronted with the question of how do we form solidarity in our ranks, these three unions got together, the workers in these three different unions got together and actually argued among themselves that for the first time, actually since the early 1960s, they were going to initiate and lead a Martin Luther King Day march. And in fact, they elected black women to the leadership of their sort of united kind of strike newspaper, which hadn't happened in decades in the United States and, by the way, hasn't happened since. And it was the course of the actual struggle itself that compelled people to confront some of these ideas. There were arguments. It's not as though, you know, once you go into strike, you're all of a sudden put on your progressive head and you've got the best ideas in the world. People argued it out. There actually weren't any revolutionaries down there initially. We certainly got wind of it and went down there. And you'd better believe it. And then they began to tour around the entire United States, and they called themselves road warriors, and they had a whole campaign. And the ideas and the struggle and the fight actually spread from one town to the other, so that people built solidarity in cities across the United States with this little town that they had never heard of, in which a third of the population was out on strike or locked out. Now, we, as revolutionaries, of course, are confronted with a certain caricature of what it means to have a revolution. Now, the caricature of a revolution that's passed off by most historians, of course, is that of a small group of pretty heavily armed fanatics who seize control of the government and basically run it to enrich themselves. That's essentially the story we're all told in different languages and dialects, but that's pretty much the same story the world over. And really, we understand as socialists that this has absolutely nothing to do with socialism as we Marxists understand it. It has nothing to do with genuine socialism. A minority, no matter how well intended that minority may well be, cannot carry out a socialist revolution. At the heart of socialism, to us as Trotskyists, as people who believe not only in revolution, workers' power, and self-emancipation of the working class, who follow the ideas of a tradition known as Trotskyism, one of the leading revolutionaries who led the Red Army during the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, we understand it this way. This is the way Trotsky explained the revolution. I think it's quite clever. He said, the most indubitable feature of a revolution is the direct interference of the masses in historic events. In ordinary times, the state, be it monarchical or democratic, elevates itself above the nation, and history is made by specialists in that line of business, kings, ministers, bureaucrats, parliamentarians, journalists, etc. But at those crucial moments when the old order becomes no longer endurable to the masses, they break over the barriers excluding them from the political arena, sweep aside their traditional representatives, and create by their own interference the initial groundwork for a new regime. The history of a revolution is for us, first and foremost, a history, a history of forcible entrance of the masses into the realm of rulership over their own destiny. And in fact, that was the real history of the Russian Revolution, far from, you know, some putschist led by some guy named Lenin, who was so clever that he managed to seduce the entire population of, you know, of some 150 million or so, whatever the population was at that time, of Russia, into overthrowing the Tsar, taking over control of industry and running society entirely differently. No, hardly, far from it. Nobody, as a matter of fact, most of the people in the Bolshevik Party didn't even agree with the fellow. They had all sorts of arguments. They thought it was a complete crackpot. They had two revolutions, in fact. The first one got rid of the Tsar, and they said, okay, now we've done it. Now we've had our revolution. He said, what, are you crazy? Now you've got to take control of the property. You got rid of the top guy. Now you've got to get rid of the entire class of owners. And that was an enormous argument. But it was in the course of that struggle, in the course of those months between February and October of 1917, that the masses entered into the state, that the working class in enormous numbers formed these things called Soviets. In Iran, during their revolution, they called them shortas, and other places they've been called all sorts of committees. Essentially, workers' councils got formed in which debates happened, fights happened, some fist fights too, undoubtedly. People were arguing about real things, about whether, you know, questions that were going to shape whether or not they were going to survive or whether or not they were going to be crushed. There were important battles that took place, and it was millions of people who stepped onto the stage of history for the first time, millions of people debating into the night. In fact, Lenin's wife describes walking down the street and how it used to take hours to go from one, you know, just get home, because there would be all these circles of people who for the first time had a stake in what was going on and were playing a central role in the shaping of their futures. We're standing on every street corner arguing everything from, you know, what would it mean, you know, should we be armed, do we get rid of this guy over here who's sort of a semi-reformist, or do we work with him for a period of time, all sorts of debates, and people came to the resolution for themselves that they needed to not only overthrow the one fellow at the top, but the entire layer of people at the top. They're mass events, and there's excellent books in the back here on revolutionary rehearsals that gives you a flavor for what it looks like when masses of people move onto the stage of history and began to act on their own behalf. So the armed insurrection to seize control is really only for us as socialists the final act of revolution. That in fact it is a climax to a long process of struggle. Now, ideas in struggle and the aims of the struggle usually shift in the process of the actual battle. If you look at the civil rights movement in the United States, very instructive. In 1960, there was a forming of a group called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. One of the women who formed that group was quoted as saying this. This was the aspirations that she had. And she wasn't just somebody who had floated into a meeting one day. This is one of the leading members. She said, maybe one day a Negro will invent one of our nuclear missiles. That was the aspirations that she had in forming the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Now, 8 years down the road, not only were the members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee carrying guns, which is a reaction to what they had happened to them, slaughtered in the streets, beaten by the cops and all the rest of that, but the demands were no longer for a Negro to perhaps one day invent work on a weapons of mass destruction, but for black power, for revolution, for all sorts of extraordinary demands. The experience of the fight, the experience of even trying to get seated as a black person in the Democratic Party in 1964 at the convention, and then being told, oh, no, 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 even though you come from the state of Mississippi where 40% of the population is black, we can't have any black people in your in the Democratic Party seated at our convention. That was President Johnson, the great man who led the, led the war on poverty. He was supposed to be a great progressive in the United States. Oh, no, you can't sit at our convention, because that would bring disunity to our ranks. That would mean that the racists inside of the Democratic Party, which used to be known as the Dixiecrat Party, they would flee. So we're more interested in holding on to them, because after all, they've got money. Who the hell are you? You're just a poor black person. Get the hell out. The experience of that had millions of people across the United States break from the ideas of not only, wanting to build weapons of mass destruction, break from the ideas that a reformist party like the Democratic Party spoke for them and actually began to organize their own political party, their own organizations with their own aspirations, of course, culminating in groups like the Black Panther Party and the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement and all of these fantastic organizations that led rather militant struggles and, yes, had to arm themselves and actually, led many of the uprisings in many of the urban centers of the United States. They tried sitting in. They tried peaceful resistance. They got mowed down. And they decided, well, if they're not going to listen that way, we'll find another way for them to listen. We'll burn their shit down. Well, they certainly paid attention then, didn't they, when a few billion dollars in property damage was done. That's when they began to pay attention. So the basic problem, however, we face in all of this, something that is a contradiction not made by us as socialists, but actually one that the world presents us with. We understand as Marxists that the dominant ideas in society are the ideas in the ruling class, and yet we Marxists are, stubborn enough to insist that genuine socialism is about the emancipation of the working class. Well, you got a problem there. You're really screwed. The people at the bottom of society are being constantly proselytized or propagandized about, with shitty ideas, and yet they're the ones who are supposed to transform society. Screwed. Not really. We have a dialectical understanding about the way things work, and what we understand is that what you need inside of this contradiction that the world has presented us with is a revolutionary socialist organization. You need organized forces of people who are comprised of some of the most forward-looking, the most advanced consciousness, the people who understand that all workers have a common enemy in the boss class, and so you have to stand up to oppression of every sort, whether it's against blacks or immigrants or what have you, and a group of people who have a sense and a history of past struggles, because most people, of course, who've grown up in our society, have been schooled by our education system, have been denied their history of struggle. They don't teach you in the United States about May Day. Just because May Day started in Chicago, I would guarantee you that 90% of people living in Chicago have no idea what the event of May Day is. Absolutely guarantee you. Maybe they do after last year, after last May. But prior to last May, they didn't. Prior to last May, I absolutely guarantee you they had no idea that May Day started as a result of a fight for the 8-hour day in which the police mowed down, created an incident that then they used to execute the leadership of that movement. You need a group of people that can generalize from the struggle, a group of people that have studied and analyzed the situation over a period of time, who have looked at, what was the history of that revolution? Well, what worked? Well, what didn't work? Why did it fail? What was the problem? Was it just bad leadership? Was it that it had crappy politics? All of these kinds of things. You need to have an organization that essentially we understand as Leninists to be a vanguard organization. There's lots of anarchists and people like that that have trouble with that word, but I think it's a sort of an interesting sort of trouble. We all recognize that why would you have an anti-racist movement led by racists? I mean, it's the most ridiculous idea of all. So what we're basically saying that we believe that you need to have a vanguard organization made up of people who have the highest levels of class consciousness, who are consistent in opposing oppression of every sort, who are anti-imperialists, who aim to root themselves inside of the working class and all the rest of that. You're simply naming a truism. You're saying if we're going to be able to lead a struggle to shift the world, then you actually have to understand something about how it works. And you want to gather together with you, not a debating society of some people who are racist and some people who are anti-racist and some people who think that imperialism is occasionally good in East Timor, but it's really not so good in Iraq. You can't have that. Then you're building a club. You're building a grad student study program. That's not what we're interested in doing. That may be interesting for some people, not particularly for us. We don't talk about ideas for talking about ideas' sake. We talk about ideas because we actually want to use those ideas as tools to change the world. And for that, you need a political party, a revolutionary socialist party. As individuals, we understand we're atomized, we're weak, we're ineffective, and organization allows, to the best of ideas of our class, to basically be able to be acted on and channeled in a struggle into victory. It's not that we believe that somehow revolutionary socialist organizations sort of, I think people sometimes have a crude idea that our notion is we just get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and then we're going to be at the heart of, we'll be in a position to somehow initiate a revolution. Horseshit. Forget about that one. Capitalism, because it is fraught with contradictions, because you have the most powerful empire on the planet on the one hand, and yet 150 million people in society only have as much as 300,000, you know, rich parasites living on the Upper East Side of New York and Los Angeles and a few streets in Chicago. That contradiction alone, these kinds of fucked up realities that capitalism produces in society, that's what compels people to struggle, not because they happen to run into a member of Socialist Alternative. They'll struggle whether you're here or not. I got news for you. We're not that special in that regard. What we are special about is that we have certain ideas in the struggle that can help determine whether or not it wins, or whether or not it goes down to defeat, or whether or not it just stops after making a gain or two, and then, you know, sort of sits back and says, okay, we've won a reform or so, which of course we want to fight for. Most of our lives, by the way, as revolutionaries, are spent fighting for reforms, right? You know, any of the war, by the way, is not a revolutionary demand. I mean, we're still going to be left with imperialism and capitalism after this war is long done. But whether or not you have an organization with good ideas, with good politics, with an analysis about the way society works and a way to take it forward can actually transform whether or not a struggle wins. For example, right now it matters that inside of what have been at moments in time, we've all talked about the explosions of February 15th of 2003. Well, why weren't there millions of people marching in the street 2 months later or 6 months later or a year later? Well, the reality is most people who went out on February 15th of 2003 throughout the world, including the United States, said, shit, we had a protest. It didn't end the war. I'm depressed. Well, you know what we learned? One protest doesn't bring down empires. That's really not the way it works, especially when you spent 20 years defending every imperial adventure in Somalia, the little one in Haiti, the one over here in Panama. You can't go support imperial adventures for decades and then say, no, this one we oppose, and then expect them to say, oh, sorry, we didn't mean. That's not the way it works. So you actually have to have organization that brings in the best politics. We just talked about in the last session Palestine. Palestine is nowhere debated on the left in the United States at the top of the anti-war movement. Why? Because it would embarrass the people that they're tied to. It would embarrass the Democratic Party, who are frankly historically much more aggressive at defending the state of Israel against the Palestinians than the Republicans ever have been. There's all sorts of historical weird reasons about it that we won't get into here, but that's reality. And so it doesn't get debated, and it doesn't get fought over, and it doesn't get included as one of the fronts in the war on terror that we as a movement have to fight against. We revolutionaries bring that argument into it. Right here, you know, you have similar kinds of arguments as we have in the United States. The Labor Party here clearly plays a different role than the Democratic Party in some regards, but both of them appear to have played roles at various times as being the graveyards of social movements. We've got to build an alternative to the left of those parties, of those political parties, because they're hostile to our class interests. Those politics actually are gold inside of movements, and without them being argued out, without the literature, the magazines, the newspapers, confident and articulate spokespeople to advocate for those kinds of positions, those ideas are not going to just simply appear somewhere, somehow, magically. It doesn't really work like that. And the reality is, we understand that most of our time, you know, people are going to leave here from this conference. People are inspired. There's a few hundred people together and all the rest of that. But most of our work in day-to-day is going to be fairly inglorious stuff. You put up a bunch of flyers. You have a meeting of 15 or 20 people. It doesn't appear that, you know, even your small Australian empire is going to fall anytime soon. It's not going to. But we understand that is the crucial building blocks to enable us to actually make a difference when things do explode. Because we do understand that we haven't fallen into some sort of black hole of history. The contradictions of capitalism haven't gotten resolved. In fact, they're more horrific today than they ever were, whether you're here on this end of the planet or on my end of the planet. Same thing. And so, really, we understand that even small groups of people can have a disproportionate impact to their numbers. I mean, I've been talking throughout the week about the immigrant rights movement, the struggle in the United States. the woman running the demonstration in Los Angeles, where over 1 million people marched, was a member of the ISO, school teacher, 27-year-old school teacher. Why? Because there's no organization in the United States. So somebody who's a school teacher, who's bilingual, who's been part of these various struggles for the last several years, had more legitimacy to be up there than anybody else and was up there at the platform and, you know, mobilizing people and, you know, giving people ideas. The comrades in, you know, small towns, you know, built demonstrations many, many times their numbers. And I'm sure you guys have examples of that here. That's a reality because a small group of people with a good set of ideas, good politics, who are open, who are collaborative with other forces on the left, you can make all the difference in struggles that are actually numerically many, many times your size. Now, I want to just sort of bring this to a close and let the discussion get going by just saying a few words about where things, I think, are at now for those of us who are fighting for socialism. Because really, we talk a lot about the deep trouble that the U.S. empire is in, and that's very, very true. But a wounded beast is very, very dangerous. It's not as though, because they're losing in Iraq, they're going to end the war. That's not the way empires operate. In 1968, at the Tet Offensive, when the Vietnamese, the Viet Cong struck out against the United States forces in Vietnam, it was clear to the U.S. government that they'd lost. Absolutely clear. That war dragged on for 5 more years. Actually, they expanded the war. They took the war on the road to Cambodia. They took it into Laos. And actually, most of the deaths as a result of that war, both in Southeast Asia and inside the U.S. military, were after 1968 when they had already lost that war. This war is not going to end soon, comrades. This is not on its last legs, I guarantee you. Even that whole faux debate that's going on right now in Congress with 1 million different caveats about with time withdrawals and timetables and all the rest of that bullshit. The reality comes down to this. It costs $1 a barrel to get oil out of the ground in Iraq, the second largest repository of oil in the world. They get to sell it at $60 on the market. They are going to get that oil come hell or high water. And we are going to have to fight them tooth and nail to stop them. This is not going to end because they're losing. They are going to fight back, and they are going to use treachery in order to try and get that way. If you look at the British Empire at the end of its height in the 1940s, the end of occupation of India was not a pretty sight. Millions and millions died at the end of that occupation. The other, you know, and there's no immediate competition, by the way, to replace the United States. They don't just simply slip off the stage because they're beaten. The military still, you know, has more than the world, the U.S. military alone has more armaments and, you know, material and all the rest of that and spends more than the entire world, you know, put together. So they're not going anywhere anytime soon. And I think we also have to remember, as encouraging as what happened when the empire was beaten last time in Vietnam, they were able to recover from it. However, it took them decades to do so, and it creates an opening for the left to be able to do things that you can't when they're at their strength. The fact that the black struggle was able to make enormous gains, the women, the gays, the fact that the labor movement expanded, you had all sorts of tremendous gains. People felt that a boot was off of their neck, and not just around the world, but internally, the people who experience the empire within every single day. But we also have to remember what vile creatures our rulers are. These people are absolutely dead set on having their way and getting their profits any possible way. A lot of people look at the you know, we've just been marching out this afternoon against nuclear power. The one time in the world that these bombs were ever used, in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, this was not the final act of World War II. World War II was over. Japanese were suing for peace. The United States bombed two cities and incinerated 300,000 people in seconds as the opening act of the Cold War. They were willing to sacrifice the lives of hundreds of thousands of Japanese people, not simply because they were racist fucks, although they are racist fucks, but because they wanted to show the competing empire coming out of that war, the Russians, what they were capable of doing. That is the treachery of the people that we are up against. We have to have a serious organization in order to stand up to the likes of them. We live in an absolutely sick society, that we know. 6 million children every year die of hunger and malnutrition. Not because there's not enough food. They destroy food every day in our world. They don't have food because they can't afford it because they're poor people. The headlines of today's New York Times Read this, poor nations to bear brunt as world warms. Even global warming will be borne differently by the poor than it will by the rich. This is one quote from a fellow from Stanford. Like the sinking of the Titanic, catastrophes are not democratic. A much higher fraction of the passengers from the cheaper decks were lost. We'll see the same phenomenon with global warming. He's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. And yet we are told every day by the people who run our world that this is the best we can possibly do. We say bullshit. We can do a hell of a lot better than this, and we have to fight like hell as if our lives depend on it, because in fact, they do.